This is the third part in our multi-part series on the pharaoh Akhenaten. Now, each of the podcasts I've done on Akhenaten so far, and the remaining two that I'm going to do, are each focused on a different aspect of his character. And I'm really trying to design them as standalone episodes. So if Egyptian art is really what you're interested in, I don't think it's necessary for you to go back and listen to the first two podcasts. But if you want a little more context, you want a little fuller picture of him as a pharaoh and what he was doing, please, by all means, save this podcast, go back and listen to those other two. Now, just to reorient us really quickly, we're talking about Akhenaten, a pharaoh who came to power in the middle of the 14th century before the Common Era. And he's a pharaoh who right away starts to make major changes. He starts a religious revolution that eventually ends in the banning of the traditional religious systems and in the banning of the worship of other gods. He creates a monotheistic system where he's really the prophet of the sun god named the Aten, and he's the only one who's permitted to worship that god, and then everyone else is forced to worship that god through him. He closes down the traditional temples, he stops the festivals, and he founds a new political capital in a city called Amarna. And Amarna is really the catchphrase that we'll use for a lot of the different terminologies. You know, so if I talk about Akhenaten's artistic style, or I refer to it as the Amarna art style, you know, those are really synonyms. The ancient name for Amarna was Akhenaten, which is the horizon of the sun disk, or the place of effectiveness for the sun disk. And that sun disk is what Akhenaten really focused a lot of his artistic and religious attention on. So he's focusing on this disk. He's completely got away from the anthropomorphic traditional views of Egyptian gods that we see. Now, one of the interesting things about Akhenaten as a pharaoh, I mean, and there's many interesting things, but one of the most immediate and accessible is just that he was such a revolutionary and was so willing to make change and major change. And this is really extraordinary for a society that was inherently conservative. And part of this, I think it's a really great parallel if we're looking at the ancient Near East, right? We've got Mesopotamia, we've got ancient Egypt. When you look at Mesopotamia, you constantly see a churning. You know, you'll see the Sumerians, or you'll see a state that will come and become powerful, you know, really more like a city state. They'll conquer everything around them, and they might last a couple hundred years, and then another state comes over. So we have, you know, Sumerians and Akkadians, and we have Assyrians, and we have Persians. And that is a really tumultuous, warlike region. Now, Mesopotamia is the kind of land between two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. And that's kind of like an open area. So we just have these city-states developing because of the natural resources around, but they don't have any natural borders. So they're going to war with each other. Egypt, on the other hand, had excellent natural borders. They've got the Sahara on one side. They've got the Eastern Desert to the other, if we're looking at the East and the West. To the north, they've got the Mediterranean. And to the south, where there's Sudan, they have the Nile, but they also kind of control that region pretty well. So anybody who's going to be kind of attacking Egypt, they're going to be coming from the Levant, and the Egyptians would refer to those people as, you know, Asiatics, and that's, you know, modern day, you know, Israel, Syria, Palestine, Sinai, that area. And even those individuals would have to cross the Sinai. To the south, we have the Nubians, and in the north of Africa, we have the Libyans. And again, the Egyptians, for most of their history, are really able to kind of keep those smaller groups under control. So what that creates is a society that is looking inward for inspiration. And this cultural continuity for millennia results in artistic changes and artistic styles that really have little change. So we can look at a depiction of a pharaoh in the Roman period, and you can see it's very, very similar to a depiction we would see 3,000 years ago. The same exact poses, the same dress. You know, in the Roman period and Ptolemaic period, they kind of get crazy with the crowns that they wear. That might be a little different, but you're going to have a bare-chested king. He's going to be wearing a kilt. He's going to be standing in a, you know, smiting pose. So 1 foot forward, kind of leaning back, arm extended behind his shoulder, holding a mace, getting ready to smite the enemies of himself and of the gods. And yet, when Akhenaten came in, he was not only willing and pushing for the change in the capital and the change in the religion, he completely changes this artistic system. Now, traditional art, Egyptian art, is idealistic. And this gets into a belief about the magical properties of depicting things. You know, the Egyptians believed that by affecting the image of something, you could affect that thing itself. Think about, you know, we always, you know, talk about voodoo dolls, and you kind of have that stereotypical scene of somebody who's creating an image of somebody. They maybe steal some of their hair, they make a doll that looks like them, and they plunge needles into it or whatever it might be, and that's then causing pain to the person. Well, the Egyptians actually believed in that type of magic. So when they're creating images, you would never create somebody, especially a king, as weak or feeble, because depicting them that way might actually make them weak or feeble through a sort of sympathetic magic. So kings and most individuals are depicted with strong, youthful, muscular bodies. Now, you can see different things focused on from different periods. So, you know, you might see more of a focus on, you know, muscular legs in one period. In the Middle Kingdom, kind of interestingly enough, they still have those kind of strong bodies, but their faces become, you know, often in some, for some pharaohs, an older, wearier, drawn face. You know, they've also got kind of bigger ears. And it's thought that all of these things have meaning, that all of a sudden there's a conception of the king, not as a young, vigorous ruler, but they're stressing him as a wise, kind of burden leader. You know, and he's got these large ears, you know, for listening to his people. So while we do see these changes, and, you know, you can certainly look at certain pieces and say, oh, this is, you know, a full-cheeked, you know, figure with a slight smile, and this very much looks like Hatshepsut, a pharaoh in, you know, the 18th dynasty, or, ooh, we've got these more almond-shaped eyes that looks like Amenhotep III. And those are things that as specialists we can see, and, you know, you can kind of see them side by side and notice that, but we're talking about minute changes. Akhenaten completely upends that. Now, I need to kind of go over one other aspect of Egyptian art. And that's that when we think about art, especially in the West, there's a big focus on perspective. The idea that we're looking at something as we would see it. If we're looking at a Greek statue, if we're looking at, you know, an object or a painting, of course, in the modern era, we have, you know, more abstract art and impressionistic art. But for many, many millennia, the idea was, you know, that you're looking at a representation of what you would actually see from that viewpoint. But that's not what Egyptian art was about. Egyptian art was about aspect. And what I mean by that is it didn't focus on the physical, visual appearance of what things look like. It focused on the characteristics that that person or whatever was being depicted was supposed to have. You know, when you look at the images of kings, you know, quite often you'll see a king in battle. And one of the things that's often noted is, you know, individuals can't stand that way. It's not physically possible, the way the shoulders set versus the legs versus the arms. And you can really see this when you see kind of buildings created. Buildings represented in art will often have what would look like the facade of the building. But then above that facade will be essentially a floor plan where you'll have all the different, you know, views of that building as though it were a bird's eye view. So you're looking down. So it's kind of part architectural plan, part facade, mixing in all of these different elements of that building. So Egyptian art was never really concerned with that, what we would think of as visual, you know, real life perspective. Akhenaten changes that a bit. So all of a sudden, when Akhenaten comes about, we see a portrayal that's much more realistic. We move from this idea of aspect and this idea of an idealized figure. And just to give you an idea of how idealized this figure was, when we're talking about just a couple generations before Akhenaten, we're talking about the Pharaoh Hatshepsut, she was a woman. Everyone knew she was a woman. But she's depicted as a man on all her images. Again, because, to depict the Pharaoh as a woman would be something that would be, a little bit unheard of, because, again, it's going back to that idea of that's not the norm, that's not the ideal. The ideal for a king is a strong, male, powerful ruler, so we're not going to depict a pharaoh as a woman, even though that's what she was. And of course, then when they're depicting her, they're depicting her, as a man and as a youthful man. But when Akhenaten takes over, we see that we start to have the depiction of a more realistic, but not really realistic, because especially early on in Amarna art, we're looking at figures that have super elongated fingers and toes and necks and drawn, really long chins. It actually looks kind of like we're looking at caricatures. If you've ever visited a carnival or an amusement park and there's the individuals, who are willing to draw your picture, but they focus on some aspect, right? If you have a large chin, they may make that really large, or a large nose. They're kind of like that. These images have thin, long, narrow necks, sloping foreheads, a really prominent chin that kind of juts out from the face, really big, full lips and ears, thick, thick thighs and hips, moving really, even into a chest that looks like we're looking at, breasts. There's a paunchy stomach, and then very, very thin legs and arms. I mean, really spindly is the best word for it. Now, within this period, we also see that in addition to that change of getting rid of the traditional religious structure, they've gotten rid of all the religious imagery. All the anthropomorphic images of the gods are gone. We only have the sun disk depicted in an actual, what looks like attempt to be kind of a round sun disk or roundish. It's usually, you can see, set in very deep relief and then kind of curved out. I don't think the Egyptians really had a concept of the sun as a globe or a ball, but they do kind of give it a little bit of that feel. And we see Akhenaten, and interestingly enough, members of his family underneath that sun disk, the Aten, and its rays are reaching down and touching them. And in some of the images, you can even see it's holding an Ankh, the Egyptian symbol for life, up to their nose. The idea that the sun disk is really giving life to Akhenaten, his wife Nefertiti, and their daughters. Now, this new artistic form was not limited to any single medium. It's what you would see in painting. It's what you would see in sculpture. And what you would see in wall relief, those etchings that are done on tomb walls and on the temple walls. And it's thought that, or at least I should say, it was thought early on by some Egyptologists that we're moving to an attempt for realism, but that this attempt at realism is because the pharaoh is sick. The pharaoh has some sort of disease that causes him to actually look like this. Now again, right, for all the reasons I've kind of mentioned before, even if he was sick and this was a health issue, they wouldn't depict him this way, because that would be reinforcing that injury, that malady. But people looked at things like, did he perhaps have Marfan syndrome or some other, Froelich's disease, something like that, that caused him to have these, some might say, kind of mixed gender features. But I think that there's something actually more going on there at a deeper level. I think it's very interesting, and this is my own personal view. I've never seen it at least published elsewhere, although, other Egyptologists might think the same. I think it's almost an attempt to show himself in the style of a god named Hapi. And Hapi is a god of fecundity. He's a god of fertility. He's a god of potency. He's the god of the Nile, of the Nile flood. So every year, the Nile flood is what brings in fresh water. It brings in really fertile earth from the highlands of Ethiopia that acts as a natural fertilizer. And he's depicted as a figure who doesn't look like Akhenaten, but he's shown kind of, you know, with fat rolls and what are often described as pendulous breasts, and he has a plant on his head. And I think that, you know, he has that kind of connection to potency that Akhenaten might be going for, and that Akhenaten is depicting himself in a similar way as maybe a fertile figure for his people. And he may even be in a way taking on masculine and feminine attributes to kind of highlight that he is supposed to be everything to the people. Again, we can never really know what's going on, but I think that a piece of that clue might even be seen in the imagery for his daughters. And when we look at the daughters of Akhenaten, we see that they have these heads which are egg-shaped. And many individuals thought that this was actually reflecting that they were practicing skull binding, which some cultures do. In fact, I was just looking at some Peruvian mummies the other day, and you can see there that from birth, the heads are wrapped and the skulls are shaped, and they're shaped in really fantastic ways that would be tribal, that they would shape them and mold them in these forms. And you can actually see, you know, these type of elongated egg-shaped skulls. You can see ones with kind of two protruding, you know, skull patterns. So they would do these different things, and it's something that other cultures have done, but we don't see any physical evidence for that within Egypt. You know, we have the pharaoh of Tutankhamun, you know, we have some of, you know, his, you know, daughters that seem to have died as fetuses, but we also have some other mummies from around this period, some of which, even if we're not exactly sure who they are, they seem to be royal, and there seems to be no evidence for that actual, you know, skull binding practice. So we have these kind of egg shapes, and the egg is, like it is in many cultures, a very important symbol of fertility and of life in ancient Egypt. So when we see these images of the king in this kind of, you know, very, you know, large form with these wide hips, you know, I think that that might be, along with the images of his daughters, you know, kind of maybe hearkening to creation. That idea of Hapi, who's a fertile god, his daughters who kind of have this creative potential of the eggs. I think that that could be one of the motivations in drawing from that imagery. At least that's one of the ideas that I have about it. Now, another thing that he does that really breaks with tradition is he starts depicting the royal family together. He has depictions of himself and his queen Nefertiti, not in the stereotypical way you might think of it, where the king is standing before a god, his wife is behind him, and that's kind of it. We actually see him and her seated across from each other. In some scenes, we see Akhenaten holding his daughter to his mouth while he kisses her, and we see his other daughters, only daughters, not sons, climbing on his wife Nefertiti, you know, or climbing on him. And it's a very intimate, personal scene, the type of which we don't see before or after this period. We also see evidence of things like holes for earrings or earplugs within their earlobes. And we see wrinkles available in places there. So it really does seem like we're mixing this caricature and an attempt to go for an effect with aspects of realism. And early on, the style is definitely more extreme. So Akhenaten doesn't found his new capital until year 5. Before that, he's building religious structures to the sun disk, to the Aten, in the temple of Amun, or I should say rather the precinct of Amun at Karnak. And there we see that the style is more extreme. It's more of that kind of caricature that I said before. Now, many people, because again, this changes so fast, happens pretty quickly, it seems, after he takes over, and because it's more intense early on, people think that, you know, this is a good evidence that he actually was the driving force behind this change. And we see evidence of this because, or I should say rather, we interpret that this might be a work in progress and perhaps that it's so severe early on because the artists are struggling with this. They're more rushed. They're going against all their training to create these new images and they're struggling with it. But as time goes on, it does kind of soften. And by the time we get to the end, or I should say close to the end of the Amarna period, we end up with that famous bust of Nefertiti that is in the Neues Museum, but that most people have probably seen. And I should say now, before going on any further, I am going to create a photo image of this to put on my website. So you can go to my website, ericsguidetoancientegypt.com, and I'll have a gallery of all sorts of different images from the Amarna period. And I'll probably put up a gallery of traditional images as well, but I think for anybody who's seen any kind of traditional Egyptian art, as soon as you see these images from Amarna, one, you're going to recognize them. You may very well have seen them before, but two, you're going to notice how different they are. So, but by the end, we really get to some of the high points of Egyptian art and of art for all of the ancient Near East, kind of embodied by that example of that tomb from Nefertiti. There's realism, but there's softness, and it's quite beautiful and striking, many of the pieces that we have. Now, I've given you kind of my own theory about, you know, what might be the reason why he depicted himself this way. I don't believe that he had a disease. There's really no reason to assume that. From the mummies we have from this period, we can't tell that there was any sort of genetic defect. And one of the things that we see is that if there was some sort of genetic defect, many of the genetic defects that cause people to look this way result in sterility or they're genetic. Now, there is some problem with identifying the different mummies that we have, and we don't necessarily have an identification that this is Akhenaten's mummy or this is one of his daughters. We know Tut, but there's even some speculation as to, is Tut actually related to Akhenaten, and if so, in which way? And we'll get into that a little bit in the next podcast. So, again, we have these drastic changes to the artistic system. We have this really striking change, but it doesn't just stop at visual art. Akhenaten actually makes major changes to literature as well. So one of the things we should again look at when we're looking at ancient Egypt is this idea of conservatism, this idea that the ancient Egyptians are of intensely conservative culture. And we can see this in the writing system. Most Egyptian writing is done, especially for formal documents or religious documents, in a phase of the Egyptian called Middle Egyptian. So when Egyptologists talk about the Egyptian language, we've actually got a couple major phases that we talk about. So we've got Old Egyptian, which is kind of very early on. We've got Middle Egyptian. And think of Middle Egyptian something like Shakespearean English. It's seen as the high point of the language for many people. And really, you know, it's something that they're going to continue writing in that form of the language, even into the Ptolemaic period. We have Late Egyptian, which is a more vernacular form, a more kind of form that was similar to what people spoke for a couple hundred years ago. That actually evolves then into a form called Demotic, which is a form that, again, is really kind of more common form used by the people. And then eventually we have the final phase, which is Coptic. And Coptic is Egyptian language written with Greek letters and then with some other special characters that represent the Egyptian sounds that the Greeks didn't have. So these are the language phases that take us all throughout Egyptian history. And Coptic even today is still alive within the Coptic church in Egypt. So it survives as a liturgical language, although not really as a spoken language. Well, within this period, Akhenaten makes the drastic shift where he begins switching from that Middle Egyptian to actually making religious compositions within Late Egyptian. And to give you an idea of how revolutionary, you know, this would be, think about today and think about the way we speak. And then imagine that all of our kind of official state documents and all of our religious documents were written in something like Old English. We're written in the type of language we would expect to read something like Beowulf in or like Chaucer in. But within Egyptian, there's even a more major change than that. You know, it's not just that the Egyptian vocabulary would change. The language itself fundamentally makes a switch from a verb subject object language to a subject verb object language. So we, for instance, have a subject verb object language. We, you know, we say, you know, man, you know, bites dog. That's how we would speak. And if we say dog bites man, that completely changes the order. The Egyptians, for Middle Egyptian, wrote things verb subject object. So they would say bites man dog. And that means a man bit a dog. When the time comes that late Egyptian is being spoken, though, it all of a sudden switches to, you know, the dog bites a man or the man bites a dog, the same order that we would keep it in. And I hope this example is not becoming too confusing because I'm talking about dogs biting men and men biting dogs. But I just want to give you that example of that's how radical of a change it is. It's switching from a formal phase of the language to a very informal one that people could understand. So maybe a better analogy is actually looking at kind of the Reformation of Martin Luther, that we're switching from an archaic form of the language that most people probably couldn't really understand to a new form that's spoken by people that everyone can understand. Now, very few people were literate, so they're not going to necessarily be able to read this. That would probably only be a very, very small elite group of people. But they could understand it better when it was being written. And we have beautiful compositions. So for instance, I'll read a little bit to you now from the great hymn to the Aten. How manifold it is what thou hast made. They are hidden from the face of a man. O soul God, like whom there is no other, thou didst create the world according to thy desire while thou were alone. All men, cattle, and wild beast, whatever is on earth, growing upon its feet and flying high, flying with its wings. The countries of Syria and Nubia, the land of Egypt, thou settest every man in his place. Thou suppliest their necessities. Everyone has his food, and his lifetime is reckoned. Their tongues are separate in speech, and their natures as well. Their skins are distinguished, as thou'st distinguished every foreign people. Thou makest a Nile in the underworld. Thou bringest forth as thou desirest to maintain for the people of Egypt. According as thou madest them for thyself, the Lord of all of them, wearying himself with them, the Lord of every land, rising for them, the Aten of the day, great of majesty. So here we have what's one of the most beautiful compositions kind of Egyptian religion, this great hymn talking about the sun god. And talking about the sun god as the Aten that shines for everyone, that wearies himself for everyone. It's quite beautiful. And again, he's made this change to a system that it's now a bit more accessible. You know, these type of hymns would have been read, and the people are now going to be able to understand this a bit more. So this really seems like the type of thing for us where, again, Akhenaten is this extraordinary figure who's invested in, really, it seems like, completely upending every aspect of the religious system and the political system, and as we can see here, the artistic system. He's this revolutionary figure who makes major changes to every aspect of religious, political, daily life for everyone at his court. And depending on kind of how much you see this influence extending throughout the entire country. So when you see somebody who makes these major changes in a culture that is so conservative, it's probably no mistake that he seems to have been a figure that after his death was very reviled, that the attempts that he made were completely reversed. They went back to all the traditional ways. His city was abandoned. And it really is something where we can only speculate as to why he wanted to make such radical changes. You know, for me, I'm perhaps a bit of a cynic. I think it's very much about power, and it's about him politically maintaining a strong control over the country, setting himself up as a figure who's going to oppose the growing power of the priesthood of Amun. But he didn't have to make these fundamental changes to do that. The Egyptian king was, by definition, the high priest and the political leader. He had all that power. And he could have, no doubt, taken on the priesthood in another way. And yet, he chooses to reform every aspect of Egyptian high culture. So, that's it for Akhenaten the artist. I know this is probably a little bit shorter and a little bit more abrupt, and hopefully it's a decent episode of the podcast. I realize it's a bit difficult to talk about, you know, art and in a simply auditory way without having pictures. And as I said, I'll put some pictures up, but hopefully you'll enjoy this. And again, I think it's really necessary to talk about this aspect of him, because we do see, and we do have texts where sculptors say that they're instructed by the king to make these images and these sculptures, and that they're taught by him himself. They kind of make a point of that. So he really is the prime mover behind all of these changes. So, unfortunately, our story with Akhenaten is about to come to a close. In our next episode, we're going to be talking about the end of the Amarna period. And again, we're going to perhaps bookend nicely to the first episode, if you listen to that, Akhenaten, the fascist pharaoh, where we talk about him as this political figure who's doing everything he can to maintain control. We're going to look a little bit about that in the next podcast and see what extents he went to try to secure an heir for himself. And it seems as though he actually, with not just one, but multiple of his own daughters, married them as soon as they came of age and attempted to have children with them. So that's what we're going to be talking about next time on Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt, Akhenaten the Monster. Now, before I launch into my normal thank you and plugs for where else to get the show, I just wanted to say thank you to everybody who's been filling out the PodTrack survey. That's very helpful to me. It's able to show me who listens and what you like and what you don't like, and I can make changes to the podcast based on that. And I also wanted to thank you all for writing reviews through iTunes. Haven't yet, just simply rating the podcast on iTunes and writing a brief review is one of the top things that you can do to really help the podcast that's free. It takes a couple minutes for those of you who listen through iTunes, but it actually is what they use to help generate their rankings. So when they look at podcast rankings, they look at how many downloads you have, how many subscribers, mixed with how many people actually give you a review and take the time to write a review. So by doing all of those things, that's a nice free way you can help support the podcast. It makes it go higher in the charts, and then more people can see it and listen to it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. I truly appreciate you taking the time to listen to the podcast. If you like the podcast, please subscribe to it and rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever format you listen to it on, if they allow that. If you have any questions or any feedback you'd like answered on the podcast, please, you can feel free to get in contact with me on ericsguidetoancientegypt.com, or also through our Facebook page, Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt, or on Twitter at Eric's Egypt. I also have an audience survey on my Twitter and Facebook pages, so if you'd like to give me any suggestions or feedback there, please feel free, and thanks for listening.